Hi, Kelvin.
Hi.
Hi. We are into this series of recordings in which you explain how tetrionics can be regarded, can be used. And we're slowly getting into this connection between the electromagnetic fields and the particles, the physicality of matter, and how it is driven and moved by the electromagnetic waves. The whole concept of tetrionics is that we need to make a very clear distinction between matter, which is composed of quanta, but by the organization of the quanta, closed loops are formed, which makes the matter inert. But at the same time, matter has these charged surfaces, as a result of which it interacts with the electromagnetic fields, and that leads to what I would playfully call the surf riding of the elementary particles on top of these electromagnetic fields. And we've started to talk about that, and you've already said that it is really necessary to understand all this, because in biology that is actually where you most clearly see how the material structures are operated by the electromagnetic wave fields. In medicine, that would be called the physical body, or the carcass, or the cadaver. That's what people find after somebody died. That's called the hardware, which, as you say in tetrionics, is inert, it is rigid, it doesn't have any motion of itself. And then, of course, we need to look at what drives the body then. That would be the software, the electromagnetic field. The traditional term would be the mind, or the soul, or the spirit. And so then suddenly we have a direct connection between all of these, let's call it fuzzy terms that everybody sort of avoids, because the Pope told Descartes that he should leave that to the Vatican, and Descartes was allowed only to look at the physical. But in tetrionics now, the physical and the electromagnetic wave fields come together in just one integral model. And for today, you'd like to go into this relationship of the electromagnetic fields and how they connect to and drive the physical and material structures. Where would you like to start? You have already provided a couple of images on that.
Yeah, I'll mention the image numbers as we progress through, but we'll dive in boots and all, because those that are following should have covered a few basics, like the previous discussions we've had on the differentiating and defining mass and matter, being able to see which is which, and discussions on the shape of how charge brings about the shapes of matter, etc. This one, we'll start off with tetrionic illustration, tetrionics 808, which is just labeled leptonic kinetic EM fields, and it's a wordy way of saying the fields of motion associated with electrons. And that's what you see there, is electrons with various chem fields. Again, they're not to scale, because the electron is a tiny, tiny particle, and the chem field spreads out at C per second, a light second. So C squared, two-thirds of the way to the moon after 1 second, etc. But for illustrative purposes, we've drawn them here to show a few main points. First one is that everyone's familiar that as a particle is accelerated, its mass increases. It's called relativistic mass energy. The faster it goes, the more it weighs. There's a deviation from the way that's explained in tetrionics as opposed to relativity, and we'll cover that during the course of this discussion. But given the various velocities that an electron can achieve, we've got an example of 8 here, which relate back to the 8 energy levels of atomic nuclei. They're the transitions between N1 to N8 give us all the spectral colors that we see for each and every element, along with the specific characteristic spectral lines. But what we need to focus on here is not so much the charge topology of the electron, which of course is 12 negative charges, and you see that in the center illustration, the charge at the top left says negative 12, 0 positive, and 12 negatives. So the electron has a 3D material topology that gives it, that's comprised of 12 charged fascia, and has a net charge of negative 12, which equates to minus 1 elementary charges. The minus 1 simply reflects that they don't understand what, in physics, what charge is really about. Any measured charge is really a measure of the charged surfaces or the charged geometries of a particle. In this case, we're talking about electrons, so negative 12. A positron, for example, would be plus 12. So, as you can see there, the energy levels N1 to N8 correspond to different amounts of energy in the chem fields, i.e. N1 has 12 quanta in the chem field, for example. N2 would have 24. N3, 48, and it continues upwards as numbered there. Where tetraionics deviates from the standard model and relativity, apart from electrons having a specific topology as opposed to a spherical charged point, is that the energies of motion, the kinetic energies and the magnetic moments created as the particle is accelerated, are stored in this chem field, as I term it in tetraionics. And it simply stands for kinetic EM field, chem field for short. Coincidentally, it plays a big role in chemistry, just pure fluke and a happenstance. These chem fields are equilateral charge fields, as every field and charge field in tetraionics is. It's the arrangement of quanta within that equilateral field that create positive and negative charges. As you can see at the top center illustration, there's H nu quanta within that field, and there's always a squared number, so it's more correct to say that the energy of that field, the total energy, which is the kinetic energy, the Ke component, and the north and south magnetic dipole, or the magnetic moment, sums up to equal H nu squared, which is something that most physicists won't be familiar with, because classically it's referred to as mv squared. Tetraionics again defines the matter, or the mass of the matter of the electron, with a capital M, and the mass energies of the chem field with a lowercase m, as in mass versus matter, as per previous discussions. But the point here is that the energy and the number of Planck quanta in the electron's topology, all that goes into making an electron, does not change as it's accelerated. Even though the mass energy increases as per relativity, the electron itself remains the same all the time. Think of it as a boat on the water creating a wake, or if you like, Starship Enterprise being accelerated at warp speed. As the ship accelerates, the ship itself does not change, only the energy content in the field around it. Now, this is where physics comes unstuck, because in relativity, everything's converted back into a energy density as per energy stress tensors, etc. And it's looked at without distinction between mass and matter. It's an important distinction to make, because as you'll see in this discussion, as I've already said, the mass of the matter topology, the electron itself, does not change. It's what I call Lorentz invariant. So no matter how much you accelerate that electron, it's always the same as its rest mass. What changes is the energy content in those fields. The fields, being mass energy, are immaterial. There's no matter content. There's nothing to detect. so far as a tangible, physical, material body. But what we can detect is the magnetic moment and the kinetic energies of that electron is accelerated at various velocities. Now, the important point, and we'll touch further on it as we discuss the relativity part, is that the charge or the Planck quanta arrangement of mass in the electron's matter topology is such that the magnetic moments of the 12 charge fascia cancel out. They're still there, but they're neutralized, as I put it. They balance each other out. North pairs with south and south pairs with north to give an overall zero magnetic moment for an electron at rest. When the electron's accelerated by an applied force, we have these energies or the mass energies of the applied force being stored in the chem field. And that's what the top illustration is all about. The matter does not change, it's invariant rest matter. But the energies of motion or the energies of the applied force go into this chem field. And the chem field, the energies that are applied to that increase, and as they increase, the kinetic energy gets stronger and the magnetic moment grows stronger. So as soon as an electron's in motion, the point charge with no magnetic moment suddenly has a magnetic moment. And that's where we break from special relativity. Special relativity has that it's a distortion of the spherical point charge that creates the magnetic moment, making it bulge out. And that bulging, so to speak, is the cause of the magnetic moment, when in fact that's not the case at all. The topology does not change, it's rigid. If you were to make a model of the electron, instead of out of paper, out of steel, or better still, cast one, that's exactly what we'd have. Think of it as a rifle bullet. It doesn't change shape, but it has a kinetic energy and it has a magnetic moment when it's in motion. So they're the important points to take away from that illustration. Number one, charge creates the matter topology of all material particles of matter. The arrangement of plus and minus charges within that matter topology determine whether a rest particle has a magnetic moment or not. But any applied force, the energy of any applied force, I should say, is stored in the chem field as mass energies. And those mass energies create the magnetic moment, send the particle in a specific direction as per that arrow. Illustration 809, then we'll quickly touch on how we can use these chem fields to get rid of basic engineering rules like the left and right hand rules, how to explain Ampere's law, etc. As you can see in that illustration, as I mentioned before, on the left hand side we have a positron, which has 12 charge fascia and no negative. So it's a plus 12 charge topology. On the right hand side, we have a minus 12 topology, affectionately known as the electron. They're the antiparticle of each other. If they were to have a mix of positive and negative charges, you'd actually have a neutrino, exactly the same size, all three particles, actually four particles. There's two types of neutrinos. And again, same situation here, the magnetic moments, the magnetic dipoles in the charge fascia cancel out, so both particles have no magnetic moment at rest, but the energies of any applied force are stored in these chem fields. And those chem fields are equilateral fields as per tetrionics, and the arrangement of the charges within, or the arrangement of the asymmetrical arrangement of plus and minus charges within the H nu squared field or MV squared field, however you want to talk about it, whether it's quantum mechanics, which is h nu squared, or classical physics, mv squared, they're the same field. They can both be represented as per the top illustrations on the left and right hand side. Simply put, I've borrowed a bit of license and said, okay, if science wants to talk about these particles as spherical particles, we'll draw them as such. We'll then draw a triangle around it to indicate motion, and that triangle will have a north-south or south-north magnetic moment depending on the charges of the particle being accelerated. That's to say, in the case of a positron, we have 12 positive charges, so the chem field that's created will be reflective of that, i.e. a north-south magnetic moment, whereas the electron has a south-north, which is reflective of a negative charge. In quantum mechanics, you'll see that orange curl symbology, the flux, inductive flux, left or clockwise or anti-clockwise, left or right, indicating positive or negative spin or curl. So we can relate it back to electrical engineering as an inductive field, and again, the inductive mass energies can be related straight back to inertial mass energies that are in relativity, and as we increase the velocity, we're putting more Planck quanta into those chem fields, their wavelength is contracted, and the mass that's measured for the particle plus its field increases, even though the particles themselves don't change. In the center of that illustration, you can now see how we tie all this back together using these chem field triangles to take the analogy of a rider on a surfboard or a boat on its wake one step further and visualize charged particles flowing in a wire, or in this case, two wires. Where you have two currents flowing in a wire, they create two forces. One is between the particles themselves, and then there's the charge, which is the most commonly measured or most common method of measuring the amperage in a circuit or in a pair of wires, and it's in fact how the definition of an ampere is defined. We have two parallel wires, and depending on the charge of the particles involved and their direction of motion, there's either an attractive or a repulsive force between the two wires. And this is important for electrical engineers, because if you have a positive and a negative cable and you draw a lot of current through them, it can create lots of problems with the flexing of power cables and even bringing power cables together so that they arc out and destroy each other. And I've been unfortunately present for a practical demonstration on that in Telstra, where we blew up an entire distribution board when we turned on the current for the distribution for a new exchange that hadn't been properly tied down. The bus bar drew too much current, drew the wires together, and the whole lot heated up and arced itself out in rather spectacular fashion. But what we see here is, even though we're talking about positrons and electrons in this illustration, the plus, E plus and E minus, that E plus could actually be exchanged for a proton. So again, electrons moving in a cable can be related to protons moving in the opposite direction, which is conventional and electron flow, conventional current, electron flow, etc., in electrical engineering terms. But what you see here is, instead of having spherical point charges moving in the cable in one direction, supposedly relativistically distorted, you see the chem fields associated with that particle, and they point in the direction of their motion. So at the top we have two positrons moving in the same direction, and if you look between the cables, you see that their chem fields will be a north-south arrangement, which indicates an attractive force. Below them, we have an electron and a positron moving in the same direction. So all we've done is exchange a positron for an electron. And you see that we have two noughts. So in that case, by changing the charge of the particles flowing in the cable in the same direction, we've changed an attractive force into a repulsive force. Looking further down, we can then swap them around a bit more out of the four possibilities, and we can have positrons and electrons, or protons and electrons, moving in opposite directions in two cables. In which case, again, we see there's an attractive north-south force being generated. And the final one is two electrons moving in opposite directions in the two cables, which creates a south-south or a repulsive force. This is often an area that gets confusing for most electrical engineers, and it brings up left-hand and right-hand rules, memorizing the forces of attraction between cables visualized as a magnetic field, with right-hand and left-hand rules again for the magnetic interactions between cables, depending on which way your thumb's pointing. You can obliterate all those rules simply by drawing the electron or the positron or the proton with a chem field pointing in the direction of motion. That's the weight that the electron's making. In reality, the applied force, or in this case the voltage on the electron, drives it in a certain direction, creating that wake. And that wake has the magnetic fields, magnetic dipoles, that interact, either attracting or repelling the two said particles, depending on their motion and their charge. All those rules are summed up there. You'll see them pop up in a few more discussions as we go through. But again, it highlights how much simpler it makes things simply by knowing the charge of the particle and the direction of motion, or even the direction of applied force. All that is distilled down to simple geometries. 8.12 then elaborates a bit further on the point of, sorry, wasn't meant to say that way, on the, sorry, again, matter of point charges. Doesn't, it sounds like a pun all the same, but they're both equally right. In physics today, point charges such as electrons, protons, etc., are drawn just as that, as a point charge, a spherical 4π topology. Tetrionics says no, because you're talking about, we know the charges, plus or minus 12 in the case of electrons and positrons, or protons and electrons. We have to draw what's really going on. So firstly, the circular idea of a positron or a proton and the circular idea of a, or model of an electron's erroneous. Firstly, because we now know that electrons have 12π topologies, or leptons have 12π topologies, baryons have 36π, and their positive and negative charges come out with the same net charge, same but opposite net charge to that of an electron. Illustrated is the electron. We can see it from a side view, so we see three of the charged fascia. There's obviously another three on the other side, and then there's the fascia in between those triangles that create a repulsive force to create the unique geometry of leptons. But as illustrated there, any chem field or any applied force, the energies of that applied force, are stored in that chem field. And because we're looking at this particle side on, we just see a planar field, and it points in the direction of motion, so the opposite direction of the applied force. The other distinction, apart from this invariant matter topology and the chem field, is where you see it, the center of that picture at the top, you see the fields, the EM fields, surrounding a point particle. Now, in the case of a chem field, it's moving in one direction. But if it were static and radiating out a field, an EM field around the point particle, historically that would have been drawn, in the case of a positive, it would have been drawn with the arrows of force pointing outwards. And they would circle around to the negative charge, and at that point they'd be pointing inwards. So the positive is a source and the negative is a sink. And that stems back from Faraday's work with sources and sinks and magnetic fields and lines of force, etc., how they were drawn. And it's remained in place to this date. What tetrionics shows us is, again, because of the energies stored in the chem fields being an asymmetry of positive and negative charges in differing directions, the positive positron, or the positive charge proton, will have a positive charge chem field. It's actually neutral for another reason we'll go into later, hence why it's drawn in blue. But this asymmetrical distribution of positive and negative charges, in which in a positive field there will be more positive than negative, and in a negative field for the electron there will be more negative charges than positive, results in those point charges having to change in their, in how they're drawn. And that's what you see there. You see the positive charge with positive energy momentum pointing outwards in its fields and negative pointing in. So there's more positive quanta in its divergent EM field, or its chem field, and there's also negative quanta pointing towards the positive by the way that the field is formed. And the opposite is true for negatives, or negative charge particles. And you see that there. In the negative charge particle, we have negatives pointing outwards. So any negative particle being approaching that negative particle will be repelled. Think of it as a magic blanket, or the surface of a pool around a beach ball. Around the negative charge, if another negative charge was to wander into that EM field region around it, it would experience all the negative energy momenta of the EM field will accelerate it away. Will first slow it down and then make it turn around and go the other direction. Whereas if a positive charge was to approach the negative charge, it will be drawn towards it because the positive charges are accelerated in. And vice versa for the positive charge. A positive will be deflected away and the negative will be attracted towards the positive. This is the beginning of explaining how Coulomb's law really works. Now note, there's no virtual particles exchanged here. There's not even technically an exchange of photons between these particles. What there is, as per our previous discussions, are these fields superpositioning or overlapping. If those two fields that are drawn there, or those two particles with their fields, were to be brought into the vicinity of each other, the negative would obviously be attracted in towards the positive, and equally the positive would be attracted towards the negative by virtue of these plus and minus charge arrangements. So what we'll do is now move on from there. Hopefully I've begun to hint at these mechanical interactions, or the field interactions, rather than the material interactions. Physics, for a number of centuries now, has been focused on looking at the material objects, looking at how they move, and then through mathematics, creating a model of what forces exist between these particles to make them move in and out. Because of the fixation on matter, we've had to now develop, in QED particularly, virtual particles, exchange particles, where one particle exchanges virtual particles or virtual photons between another, in order for them to interact at a distance. We don't need that anymore because these EM fields spread out at the speed of light. They get weaker as they spread out, but they still spread out and they're still arranged in accord with the charge of the particle and its direction of motion or applied force. And they're relativistic. So all these bases are being ticked as we go. 1406, the next illustration, just tries to sum that up by showing the any material object being accelerated, which is the capital M here, has an associated chem field. Tetrionics color codes them. Starts with red for one, orange for two, as per the standard spectral colors, up to purple for eight. And they all have varying numbers of quanta. You can specify the exact quanta by doing the mathematical equations, or you can generalize, as I've done here. Bearing in mind, all these quanta will always be a squared number. 1, 4, 9, 16, 25, 2500, 250,000, etc. They're all squared numbers. The quanta will always work out that way. And you can determine it from mv squared or h nu squared. Now, in the case of kinetic energies, everybody's well and truly familiar with the reasons and the mathematics regarding kinetic energy. It's a half mv squared. Again, tetrionics changed the formulation to have a capital M because it's the mass of the matter topology by the velocity squared. So the velocity is the square root, mv, capital M, v, would be the linear momentum. Now you can see from the illustration at the center here, in line with 1496, that irrespective of the energy levels or the velocity of motion, any chem field for matter in motion will be mv squared, half of which will be the kinetic energy, the blue section, which equates to the electric component of the field. So the blue Ke, which you'll see crop up, is a half mv squared. That's the kinetic energy component. What's often left out when talking about kinetic energies is that there's an associated magnetic moment, as I've discussed. As the particle accelerates, a stronger and stronger magnetic moment is created. And that's how we steer the electrons in the cables in electronics via Ampere's law. That's how relativity first had to be developed in order to account for these magnetic moments in bar magnets when an inductive loop is run backwards and forwards around a magnet. How does it convert an electric force into a magnetic force and vice versa? This is being brought about not by relativistic matter contractions or distortions, but by the actual geometry of these chem fields. Now, another word that you'll see come up every now and then, and more so as we get more into tetrionics, is a BEM field. A BEM field is exactly like a chem field, except there's two chem fields back to back. Now, they play an important role in biology, but a BEM field is basically an electrostatic field. It's two charged fields back to back, a diamond shape, and it's the basics of a bar magnet. A bar magnet has BEM fields around it. Because the EM components cancel out, what we see and what we measure predominantly is the magnetic moment that's created. Whereas a particle in motion has, or as is a magnetic dipole, I should say, whereas a particle in motion has a magnetic moment in the terminology. They're one and the same, but they're just differing geometries. Again, all based on equilateral Planck quanta. The two equations you see at the top there, for those interested, are just relating to kinetic EM fields. Now, or the kinetic energy of chem fields. And if you look at the equation from the left-hand side, you see that it's a half 4n pi, being 4N, being tetrahedral geometry or topology. So 4 pi charged surfaces by N number. Electrons have 12, so 3 times 4, etc. By the electromagnetic permeability of the EM field, in this case the chem field. So we have an electric component being the kinetic energy, and a magnetic moment being the magnetic permeability of that same field. And comprising the energy of that field is M, or mass, omega, either nu squared or V squared, depending again whether you want to talk about it in relativistic terms or classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is just mass velocity at the base of the equation, as you see there notated. Mass omega, nu squared, mass omega is simply Planck's constant, kilograms square meter per second, by nu squared. That's the full unified field equation for any part, for the kinetic energy of any particle in motion. So that's the blue section of that center illustration. And that always points in the direction of motion. And its linear momentum is always a pink arrow. It was always illustrated as a pink arrow. You will see it exploded out further on as diamonds. And we'll cover that in another lecture to differentiate between vector velocity and linear momentum. On the right-hand side, that same unified field equation can actually be rewritten as 2 pi, which is a half of 4n pi, mass velocity squared, or Planck, or h nu squared, divided by c squared. Why? Because the electromagnetic permeability of an EM field, as shown by Faraday, is the cross product of the electric and the magnetic permittivity and permeability, and it mathematically equals 1 over c squared. So you can, multiplying by 1 over c squared is the same as dividing by c squared. So looking at it, you can see that the kinetic energy is 2 pi, the energy, per c squared. We know that energy divided by c squared is mass. 2 pi masses is a photon. Hence why the kinetic energy is drawn as a blue area. The same as the electric field component. And it's the same geometry, and it is comprised of photons. The EM field is made up of photons of those specific 2 pi geometries. So again, it's highlighting this geometric relationship. The very central illustration, just to touch on that, again, as a standard form of notation in tetrionics, you'll see the particle in the center with its associated fields. You'll see at the top left its charge makeup, its net charge, capital Q, quantum charge, and its individual charges, plus and minus, the number. In the case of an electron, there's 0 positive and there's 12 negatives. You see it just below that is the rest mass matter. It's how many quanta of mass energies make up the matter topology. And that's invariant. And an electron, as I've said, will always have the same mass matter, whether it's standing still or whether it's moving at the speed of light or faster. What does change, as you see directly across to the right of the matter, is the kinetic energies. And again, they're made up of positive and negative charges, but there's always an asymmetry. There'll always be more negative or more positive, depending on the charge of the particle in motion. But when we add the kinetic energies of the chem field to the rest matter, as you can see at the top right, you see mass plus its kinetic energy, you get the relativistic energies, spelled incorrectly there, by the way. But to summarize, you can think of matter as the surfboard, and the kinetic energy is the wave. It's the wave that's doing the propelling. The force has been generated somewhere else along the ocean, and the wave is created, and that's what's propelling the surfboard along. Surfboard does not change length, despite what relativity will have you believe, that it changes by the fraction of a femtometer or whatever, due to the moving at 1 mile per hour, and slightly more as it moves at 10 mile an hour. Doesn't happen. The surfboard will always be the same. So these test questions you see in physics books about how do you fit a 1 mile long ladder into a 30 meter barn, and they say accelerate the ladder, doesn't happen. The locomotive does not contract as it accelerates along the railway track, nor does the ladder, nor does the surfboard, nor do you. Your material 3D matter in your body does not contract as you accelerate. But the mass energies in your chem fields do contract. As more energy is added, as you see in that illustration there, the triangles get increasingly smaller and smaller and smaller. And accordingly, the vector velocity increases. And conversely, as you slow down, you have to release some of these mass energies. The wave has to get weaker. So it releases photons and bosons, or a mixture of the two. And in doing so, the wavelengths of the remaining mass energies in the chem field grow larger and larger until they reach N1, where there's only one quantum left and it's still just in motion. And then when you get rid of that one quantum, the particle is then at rest. And because you've lost the energy in the chem field, you no longer have a magnetic moment. The electron becomes a pure charged, not so much a point particle, but it has 12 charges with no discernible magnetic moment. I know I'm laboring on here, but these are important points to sort of begin to wrap your head around how these fields work. 1407 just re-highlights what we've just covered. That is that any material object, not just electrons in this case as illustrated, it could be a proton, it could be a carbon atom, it could be a molecule, it could be a bus. Any material object has a specific mass energy content in its matter topology, and when it's a force is applied, a chem field is created. And you can even re-term chem fields to be kinetic, electric, and magnetic fields. Some people do, some people just take it as a chem field, kinetic EM. Either works, but in this case, the kinetic energy component, as I've said, is the electric component, which is comprised of photons, whereas the magnetic dipole is the green, or the aqua section. It's a dipole. The two poles are separated by the electric field, and they're comprised of photons and or bosons, depending on how many quanta are in the field. Again, the total field has a squared number of quanta, whether you're using mv squared or h nu squared, makes no difference. There will always be a squared number or an equilateral number of quanta, and there'll be an asymmetry. In the chem field, there'll always be more of a positive or more of a negative, depending on the charge of the particle in motion. So we can now relate charged fascia to fluxes and curls seen in electrical engineering. We can show that they're being made up of mass energies. They're just a planar geometry that extend out from the particle forward in the direction of motion for the kinetic energy, linear momentum and vector velocity, and sideways as per Ampere's law in terms of a magnetic field or a magnetic dipole moment. And we can illustrate them using tetrionic geometries. So whether we want to talk about inductive mass curls or inertial mass, we can do either using these geometries. 1604 just takes us a bit further than what we were talking before with sink and source particles or points of charge. And this is where we explain Coulomb's law of attraction in much more detail. What you can see there, as I discussed before, is the net charges and the matter topology of each particle. Left-hand side, in this case, we have electrons. 0 positive charges, 12 negative. Right-hand side, we have positrons. 12 positive, no negative. We could swap them for protons, in which case it would be 24 positives and 12 negatives, giving a net charge of plus 12 again. So they're covered. You can see between those two particles, in this case, either side, the extended chem fields of these particles in motion. So in both cases, the particles are traveling towards each other. And in the third example, they're doing likewise, but we've got two opposite charges. What's the difference? This is where the asymmetry of the mass energies or the Planck quanta within the chem fields really step up and explain something that physics can't explain, and that is interaction at a distance. You can see on the left-hand side we have two electrons pointing towards each other. You can see that they're made up of, their chem fields are made up of positive and negative quanta. And again, in this case, because we're talking electrons, I've highlighted the negative energy momenta, because that's what's important to an electron coming towards another electron. Because the electron's made up of negative charges, it's influenced by the negative charges. As it approaches the other electron, it encounters a headwind, if you like, of the energy momenta in the other electron's chem field. There's still some positive attracting it towards it, but there's more negatives pointing away. So an electron approaching another electron gets repelled. And conversely, on the other side, two positrons approaching each other are repelled by their positive number of positive quanta within their chem fields. So similar charges repel each other. What happens if we have a positive and a negative approaching each other? You can see that in the bottom picture. The positron, as it approaches the electron, and the field of interaction is the diamond shape in between the two particles. I'll touch on that shortly. But you see that the positron is attracted to the electron because the positive charge quanta for the electron point inwards towards the electron. And the electron's attracted to the positron because the negative charge quanta of the positron point inwards. So in the case of opposite charges, they're attracted. And for that reason, I've changed the law of attraction for Coulomb's law in words only to the tetrionic law of interaction, because there is no force of attraction, strictly or unidirectional force of attraction, or a unidirectional force of repulsion between the particles. It's always a bidirectional force. There's always positive and negative energy momenta in chem fields. It's the asymmetry, or the excess number of positive versus negative, which is a reflection of the charge topology of the particle, that creates the interaction. So it's a push and pull, with one always winning over because there's an asymmetry. How do we show that geometrically? As per that center illustration, we show the two charges, Q1, Q2, their chem fields overlapping, and you see that in the center we have a electric field interaction. Charge particles interact via their electric fields. If they were to interact via their magnetic fields, which is Ampere's law, we would draw this with the two particles slightly offset so that the magnetic fields interact. But in this case, we're talking Coulomb's law of interaction, which is this diamond shape for the E fields. And again, the E fields are superpositioned. Coulomb's law has a constant k in it over r squared, but we don't have to worry about the r squared here. The constant k is simply a measure of the energy and the vector direction of the energy momenta in that electric field interaction. The electric field, you'll find as we go further into tetrionics, you see a diamond-shaped field, you know instantly that it's an inverse square field. It tapers off or it grows weaker as a in relation to the square of the distance from the sources. In this case, we've got two sources separated by a distance. The field, the electromagnetic field for each particle is strongest closest to them, which is their equilateral geometries associated with each one. But the force of interaction is actually strongest in the middle of the two particles, assuming both particles are equal charges and moving at equal velocities. If one particle was moving faster, it would have more energy momenta due to its motion, and that center point would be shifted slightly in favor or towards the particle moving the fastest or the particle with the greatest charge. And that's what we see in the mathematical equations. So what tetrionics does with this illustration in the center is reinterpret the mathematics and give it a geometric explanation. And interestingly, you'll see it come up. You can change that geometric equation to have two matter topologies separated by a distance, and we replace the Q's with M's and the K with capital G, and you have Newton's law of gravitation explained geometrically in exactly the same terms. Coulomb's law is a law of electric interaction. Newton's law of gravitation is a law of a unidirectional convergent gravity associated to each material particle. And we'll cover that as we go on. But back to electrons with 18.02, we can now elaborate even further or expand what we've just discussed. And in 18.02, you'll see along the diagonal an electron being accelerated, starting at the bottom left-hand corner, accelerating towards the top right-hand corner. As it's accelerated by an unseen force, but you can assume that there's an applied force pointing in the direction of motion, as it accelerates, you see the colors of the chem fields changing. And you see that the quanta, if you can zoom in on it, you'll see that the quanta for the mass energy quanta for the chem fields increases, but the quanta in the electron, 1.2 by 10 to the 20, remains the same. In the case of electrons being accelerated, we normally measure them, the energy in their chem field, in electron volts. And you see the formulation for there. I won't go into it here. But this again harks back to the point of what I've said before. At the top left-hand corner, you see the four types of leptons that can be created via charges coming together. You have positrons, electrons, and neutrinos. They are all exactly the same size. However, the neutrinos have less quanta in their charge topologies than the positrons and electrons. So hence, they are lighter to begin with than the electrons and the positrons. But irrespective of that, on the bottom right-hand corner, you can see that if we start with the first generation of leptons, the positron, neutrino, electron, and we accelerate them to a given velocity, say half the speed of light, we've now changed them from electrons and anti-electrons or positrons and electron neutrinos into muons, mu neutrinos, and anti-muons. We accelerate them even further and they change from muons into tau neutrinos and tau electrons and tau anti-electrons. What is described in particle physics at present as the mass energy increasing for a particle, so it becoming heavier in the particle experiments, is not actually occurring. Even a tau neutrino is a basic neutrino. While it's moving at a given velocity, the excess or the extra energies of motion in the chem fields create this illusion or this measured illusion and assumption of the particle getting heavier. The particle isn't getting heavier. It's increasing the mass energies of its chem field. The wake is getting bigger, if you like, or the waves are getting larger with more energy. But the boat riding or the surfboard riding on those wakes or those waves remains the same, even though it's moving much faster because of the larger waves. It's still the original particle. And that's where tetrionics deviates a lot, quite considerably, from special relativity. Special relativity has the distortion of particles, and they treat particles as an energy density, so they can't differentiate between the mass of the matter topology and the mass energy of the chem field. Tetrionics can, and we use it to explain all those other points I've just touched on. So this illustration, 18.02, is a good one for people trying to get their head around particle physics and what's actually going on. A more elaborate or detailed view of that same of those same particles accelerated to their various generations is in 1803. Again, the point here in 1803 is one type of particle, three different types of charge, electrons, anti-electrons, and neutrinos, are in fact all the same family of particle. They're all leptons. They just have different charge distributions. And as we accelerate those particles to higher and higher speeds, we're measuring them with increased mass energies, and we're calling them different particles when in fact they are the same particles. The sun emits neutrinos that travel through space, interact with our atmosphere as muons, and then slow down. As the atmosphere slows them down, they lose mass energy in their chem fields because their velocity gets less. The energy in their chem field reduces, and we're left with just a small chem field and the electron that was always there. But through a coincidence of particle mechanics and how they were discovered, we've called them muons, when in fact they are the same particle irrespective of the speed. All that's changed is the energy of these fields. The magic carpet has of motion has more threads in it. It's stiffer, it's able to move faster, greater weights for the boat, however you want to use the mind model or the analogy. The energy of motion is in the chem field. As the velocity increases, the kinetic energy increases. The vector velocity increases, the linear momentum increases. The wavelength of the mass energies decrease, and the magnetic moment associated with each particle increases. So all these things interrelate, but it's still the same basic particle. 1805 relates these chem fields or chem fields of accelerating electrons to the Bohr radius. The Bohr radius, as shown in that illustration there in the center, is normally drawn as concentric rings from N1 to N8, moving further away from the proton in the nucleus. On the left-hand side, upper, of that illustration, you see the deuterium atom that makes up all elements, We won't go into why here, but the deuterium atom is the main component. It has a proton with a neutron, so a net positive charge, and that attracts, through these chem field interactions, an electron. So the negative charged electron is attracted to the positive charge deuterium nuclei. Same thing happens in hydrogen, except you don't have a neutron present. We draw the spherical point charge as a positive Q in the center of the Bohr radius. And instead of stepping out in concentric rings, we just draw the equilateral triangles, which represent an electron in this case. But we can relate the quantum levels of the energy levels of an electron to the Bohr radius. There is no physical motion away in increasing steps from the electron, from the proton. The electron at N1 is the same distance from the proton as the electron at N9, or N8, I should say. And you can see that illustrated there in the left-hand side at the top. The electron is bound to the deuterium nuclei, or to the deuteron, forming the deuterium nuclei. And as its energies are increased, i.e. as we add energies, as we applied force, and the energies of the force, applied force, are added to the chem field, normally the electron would accelerate in a straight line, as per the previous illustration. But in this case, it can't. It's physically bound via Coulomb attraction to that deuterium nuclei, and it sits there, and because it can't move in a straight line, the linear momentum, the linear vector forces that would drive it in a straight line in free space, are converted to angular momentum. So the electron rotates. It literally spins. And if you build the models of the deuterium nuclei with the electron, etc., you'll see how this works. And in fact, what the deuterium nuclei physically becomes is a quantum synchronous converter. And in that, what I'm trying to say is it behaves exactly as per the devices that Tesla and Edison built. The energy that is applied, be it spectral energy or a force applied to the electron, will create a spinning motion in the electron. It acts like a rotor. It stores that energy in a spinning motion as angular momentum. And then it can keep that energy until it's required or until it needs to change its energy levels, at which point it releases them. And that's what gives us these transition between squared energy levels in the Bohr model of atomic nuclei. The equilateral geometries of chem fields gives us the squared numbers. Remember, squared numbers are equivalent to equilateral geometries in tetrionics, particularly equilateral triangles. So to transition from one energy level to the other, we have to go from one squared number to another. In order to do that, we release a number, or a series of steps, of odd number bosons, which are the quantum levels as colored there. If you count the triangles in each colored level, you'll see that there's an odd number. 1 plus 3 is 4, plus 5 is 9, plus 7 is 16, so on, through to N8. So again, those energy levels can all be color-coded, and you'll see how even the energy of the deuterium, or the deuteron itself, affects the electron. So the electron might have N1 energy level as it's moving through free space, and it's attracted via the chem field, the fields of interaction, Coulomb's law, to the deuterium nuclei. And the deuteron may have a 25, instead of a 25 squared, it might be 30 squared energy level. When the electron of N1 binds to it, the deuteron forces the electron to spin up to N7. In other words, the energy level of the atomic nuclei that the electron binds to affects the chem energy of the electron. You might have an electron at N7 moving at high speed towards the deuteron in the converse situation, and when it binds by the Coulomb's law of interaction to the deuteron to become deuterium nuclei, it's spinning too fast. The deuteron only has 25 squared, so it says I must release some of this energy because I've only got a certain stable speed I can operate with the energy levels of the deuterium nuclei. So to do that, to go from higher speed when it's bound, when it's done. Is that okay, Otto?
I think this is where we need to reconnect. Because the sound is collapsing at this time while you're talking about the decay of the particles by the amount of energies. I'll be right back to you.
Okay.